Good morning. Welcome, survivors of Snowpocalypse 2018. I hope you had plenty of milk and bread in ready supply and that you enjoyed at least a few days with your family, snowed in with them for way too long. Family can be a blessing, but family can also be hard sometimes. Whether it's spending way too much time together when you're snowed in, or as many of us maybe had the experience this holiday season trying not to argue over politics and religion, family, according to the philosopher Nietzsche, is a lot like wallpaper, messy and clingy with annoying and repetitive patterns. But maybe that's just my family. When Jesse and I first got engaged, I was a nervous wreck when it came to being around her family, especially when we would sit around the dinner table and discuss things. Up until that point, I had managed to kind of hang out at the kids' table during family functions and avoid those conversations, but now I was at the adult table. And I remember thinking how much bigger this table was, and I knew I wasn't ready to jump in and discuss these topics that would be on the agenda at this table. So I adopted a strategy. I called it the no one can ask your opinion on something if your mouth is full of food, dinner, party, survival plan. It's a bit wordy, but very effective. And this worked great for a few months, until one fateful night, Jesse's mom served meatloaf. Now, the meatloaf was great, but amid a panic during a particularly intense conversation, I was just crushing this meatloaf. I mean, it was, give me another slice, give me another slice, give me another slice. And before I knew it, I had eaten an entire meatloaf. And Jesse's mom was so excited that I loved her meatloaf that much. And so, the next time we came over, we had meatloaf again. Only, there was the meatloaf for everybody else, and then there was my meatloaf. So I did what any loving husband-to-be would do. I ate every bite. I knew I couldn't keep this up because I was a little sick afterwards both times, but I didn't have to talk. So I was tempted to think maybe this was a long-term strategy that could work. Death by meatloaf, I called it. I guess there are worse ways to go. Eventually, however, I had to confess that I didn't like meatloaf that much. I was just nervous, and I was scared. It was awkward for many months, but I kept coming to the table. And they kept welcoming me, waiting on me to be myself. And now, I think we're as much family as maybe my own blood relatives. So what's the point? Family can be hard, yes, but what makes it harder sometimes is that we don't realize what we've agreed to. I think what I failed to recognize at first is when I said yes to Jesse, I said yes to her family. And the same is true of being a Christian. When I said yes to God, I said yes to his family. And if I was going to be a part of that family, I have to show up and bring my best self and trust that that will be enough, even if we don't agree. That, in essence, is what's happening in our text here today. The Corinthians had a hard time accepting that God's table was much bigger than the table they wanted to sit at. Because God has this annoying habit of always wanting to make his table larger. And us, much like the Corinthians, have this annoying habit of always wanting to make our table smaller, more exclusive. And whether or not you've read the Bible before, you should know that Paul's letters are not theological handbooks meant to function as instruction manuals, but they're corrective measures given to churches, communities experiencing problems. And the Corinthian church was really experiencing some problems. Some of this stuff is hard to believe. There's a guy in the church openly having an affair with his stepmother, and no one thought it was strange or sinful. Church members are attending feasts where people worshiped other gods and engaged in prostitution. Some folks are getting wasted during communion. And that's just the stuff Paul knows about. Yet the thing Paul seems most concerned with, the thing he mentions first, the most egregious sin of all, apparently, the one that sets the tone for the whole letter, it comes up again and again and again, is the sin of division. Because when you come together, you don't make things better. He says you make them worse because first, there are divisions among you. What? Of all the things to fight about, Paul, especially here in chapter 11, that's the one you're going to make your first swing. Why? Well, let's talk a little bit about what was happening, talk about what should have been happening, and then we'll finish with what maybe should happen today. Most likely, the early Christians met on the first day of the week to celebrate the Lord's Supper along with a meal they called a love feast, probably very much like a potluck. It was also an event that required the more affluent members of the congregation to step up when it came to providing the food. In this case, the church in Corinth probably met in the house of one of the more wealthy members, and there were two rooms for entertaining, the triclinium and the atrium. Think dining room and front porch. So apparently what was happening, that the more affluent members arrived early to the meal, they settled into the dining area, a place reserved for the friends of the host. They started eating and drinking before the more poor members of the church had arrived, most of whom came from jobs where they worked in the fields and less had to work until sundown, leaving little to nothing for these other members of the congregation. And they were forced to eat the scraps that were left in the atrium outside. Some scholars even think that for many of the poor members of the church, this was one of the main meals of the week, and that missing out on it may have led to malnutrition or even starvation. So in the midst of that, it's not clear where the communion ceremony or practice took place or was supposed to take place in the midst of all that. Some say before, others after. Some say it happened in the middle of the meal. However they did it, though, apparently God took great offense with what they were doing. And it led to either actual starvation or spiritual judgment directly from God, to some folks dying, whatever your interpretation may be. This is incredible, because it says that what God is most passionate about, most concerned about, most offended by, is not the things we usually think. Not sexual deviancy or smoking or whatever, but for not making a place at the table of the Lord for those who aren't like you. That is the essence and the core of the gospel. Of course, there are some people that make the argument that maybe they weren't being reverent enough. I agree with that. That's possible. But it's powerfully connected to that idea, even if that's the case. That when we sit and we place ourselves in the center, in the position of power and honor and cast aside or outside others because we think we're better than they are, we're not siding with Jesus anymore, we're siding with the folks that killed him. That ultimately is what Paul is saying here when he talks about eating the bread and drinking the cup in an unworthy manner. Not that we weren't quiet enough or reverent enough, but that we haven't made space in our lives for our brother or sister in Christ who may not think like us, act like us, or look like us. And when we do that, it is the first sign that we have forgotten the gospel. We are no longer acting like Christians, but we're acting like something else entirely. Furthermore, if I have power, or if you have power, if we have power, the reason we have it is to bring in the people from the margins, not to satisfy our own needs, but to use power the way that Jesus used it. So that's what was happening. What should have been happening? It turns out that Paul thought this little practice, at this little meal, was profoundly important for shaping Christian identity. And that every piece and every movement was meant to provide an alternative vision to the Roman way of looking at the world. For example, communion, even the way we do it now, is set up for everyone, unless I'm pulling the bread to get relatively the same amount. Have you ever thought about how radical an idea that is? Everyone gets the same amount. And if the bread represents the body of Jesus and no one gets any more or any less than anyone else, it means the death of Jesus doesn't apply more to you over me or anyone else. An equal amount of grace is applied across the board. To the people who are nailing it in life, raise your hand if that's you, so we can throw things at you. And to the rest of us. To the people you like and the ones you don't, to the smartest among us, to the fool, hypocrites and drunks, Republicans and Democrats, black and white, gay or straight, liberal or conservative, sinners and those who haven't found out they are sinners yet, the bread is offered freely and equally at the table of the Lord, because that's the way that grace works. And that's why it's offensive, my friends. If you don't think grace is offensive on some level, I submit to you, you do not know the wild and uncontrollable grace of our God. Another point. How will you and I receive the bread this morning and the juice? Someone else has to be involved. Because we can come to Christ individually, and we should, but the Lord's Supper communion dares to proclaim you cannot receive Christ fully on your own. Only through other people, and often people that don't look very much like you, or people that you may not even like all that much. Think about it. The two central practices of the Christian faith involve other people, be it baptism or the Lord's Supper. You can do neither faithfully by yourself. So this is not just taking a piece of bread and dipping it into a cup. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not the only one preaching today. We all preach when we do that. We're preaching. We're saying, I am a part of the family of God. Wherever they may be, however they may think, however they may frustrate me, ultimately, I need them to find God, because I cannot do it by myself. John Wesley put it this way: Christianity is essentially a social religion. To turn it into a solitary religion is indeed to destroy it. How much do we need that? I need that. I need that reminder from the bread that I'm broken. I'm more broken than I even know. And I need that cup to remind me that Jesus covers my sin as much as that juice covers that bread and changes it. And I think we all really, really need the reminder that we live between those two realities. I live between them. You live between them. Our church lives between them. Our world lives between them. Broken and sinful. Saved and loved. Sinners. Saints. And after we take it, and we walk back to our seats, we are reminded that we are journeying together as God's people. People we didn't choose, maybe, because maybe if we had a choice, we would have chose different people. Maybe not. Ultimately, I didn't choose these people. God did. These are God's people. And we are traveling together. So, a couple of thoughts maybe about what needs to happen today. I think sometimes when we do things in church, we just don't think about what we're doing and we go through the motions. I know I do. Maybe I'll just speak for myself. Sometimes I need a little coaching. What should I do when I'm doing this? What should I be thinking? What should I be trying? So here's maybe some questions we should ask ourselves. When I take the bread, who am I tempted in my life, maybe even in the church? Who am I tempted to cast out? Who is not welcome at my table? Who would I, if I'm honest, prefer not to receive the grace of God What relationships do I need to mend in this place or among my fellow Christians? What sin do I have in my life that is obvious, but I don't confess? What sin is hiding from me that I am unaware of? How am I participating often in the very things that I say I hate? Let me give you an example. When I first read the literature on this passage and came across the idea that the Corinthians could have literally allowed people to starve, I didn't think that was possible. I was like, that theory doesn't hold much water. That can't be right. How could anyone be so callous? And then I remembered of the thousands of people who will die today of starvation. Many of them are my brothers and sisters in Christ. How much of my efforts to defend my own inner dining room has left me blind to actual suffering in the world? How often does that upset me? What things do I get upset about that are so small comparatively? Discern the body, Paul says. Who's on the outside? Who's hurting? How have I played a part in that hurt? Because this table, is supposed to be a foreshadowing of the grand table of the Lord at the end of time. So we are compelled to ask, in what ways does this table not look like that one? Who isn't welcome here? Or doesn't feel welcome here? Who does God want here that isn't here? Let me give you a hint. He wants everybody. And the church, much like the Trinity itself, exists not primarily for those who are already here, but for those who are not. Let me say it again. The church, much like the Trinity, does not exist for those who are already here. It exists for those who are not here. Maybe that's something to think about. Maybe not. We are proclaiming the death of Jesus today, and that's the focus of the Lord's Supper, but it's not the end. It's not the end. Resurrection. Ladies and gentlemen, even though we don't act like it very much, or at least I don't in my own life, Jesus didn't stay dead. And that means no situation, no person, no feeling, no sin, no cancer, no country, no relationship, no marriage, no family, no church, nothing that has ever been made, nothing that will ever be made is beyond the resurrecting power of Jesus Christ. So whatever you're despairing over, despair no more, because despair, ladies and gentlemen, it's not something that we have to do. God is putting it all back together in ways we can't see or comprehend. So, how big is your table? Who are you tired of waiting on? Who is it inconvenient for you to do so? Who are you unwilling to give power over to? Who have we not made a place for? The temptation, as I've said, is to do what the Corinthians did, limit the seats at the table to people you like or you agree with or that make you feel better about yourself. But the truth is, that's not very exciting, and you don't really even need God for that. Anyone can do that. It's the same story we see played out in our world over and over and over. It's incredibly boring. It has nothing to do with resurrection. But to wait, to really wait, to make space for those that are different than I am, to be willing to sacrifice for people you don't even really like, people that might annoy you, or maybe even people that you might even despise a little bit. Well, that's something you just don't see every day. That's the gospel. God set a table for you. He provided all the food, all the drink, all the blessing, all the righteousness, all the goodness, all the generosity, because you brought nothing to the party. You brought nothing to the party, and what did God do for you? He waited. He waited. He waited for you. He waits for you, because the party wouldn't be complete without you. And that is the message of communion. The gospel of bread and wine, you and me, gossip and grace, waiting and wonder, small tables, and one really, really big one. In the name of our glorious God, Father, Son, and Spirit, who exists at three but also exists as one, may it be true of his church as well. Amen.